Now this talk, some of you may have heard bits of it before, but it has been put together in a new way, at least to that extent. but it's a difficult subject, and so I will try and talk without many notes. I'll try and talk from that which is my own knowledge, and that means if I can't understand a thing, I'm not going to talk about it. Because there's quite a lot here that is difficult to talk to understand. It's a fascinating subject. Now, you all know H.P. Blavatsky's hypothesis that there is one existence, that there is one life which we all share. And this is the basis, as we heard in the lecture last night, this is the basis of the concept of brotherhood. And we already had yesterday a lecture on Man, Know Thyself, which from another point of view covered exactly the same subject. When we made up the program for this convention, I didn't quite realize that the lectures were all going to be largely on this question of self-understanding or self-knowledge. But that's the way it has worked out to a large extent. So there's one field of existence, one ultimate reality, but we see the world in duality. We are consciousness and we're aware of an objective world, a material reality outside ourselves. And this material reality is based on sense perception. And the sense perception gives us memories, and from the memories and the sense perceptions we create ideas which can be abstract but are still based on our sense perception. So we see things separate, and we're seldom aware of the basic unity that lies behind all life. Some scientists and philosophers are today coming to the conclusion that the observer is the observed, but that it is limitations of perception, limitations of consciousness, which cause us to separate ourselves from that which is observed. The image we observe is usually a distorted form, or can be looked upon as a distorted form of the wholeness that is the one reality. So we have a paradox here, and in this lecture I'm going to try and explain a paradox. When I was talking to Larry this morning at breakfast, we said that it's when we have paradoxes that we don't understand that we grow in our understanding. If everything were cut and dried and neat and black and white, then we'd have nothing to sort of move us forward. But paradoxes do. And so much of the philosophy that is theosophy has paradoxes fundamentally inherent in it. And that's why, as has been said in previous lectures, H.P. Blavatsky said, we can only point the way. You can point the way, but you have to go through these paradoxes to the reality behind. Now, so I'm going to try and explain the paradox of unity and duality and multiplicity, the oneness and the dual aspects, and the many that are the separate materialistic world. And try and indicate some ways in which we can get some idea that will spark off our intuitive understanding of the true nature of the paradox of we here and the world outside, which are both the one unity, both the one reality. So such an attempt takes us into what is now being called the looking glass universe. What you're looking at yourself in the mirror is an image of yourself. but it's still yourself. What we are looking at outside ourselves in the world is actually being perceived within our consciousness. We don't know it really exists. We only know that our consciousness actually takes in and gives us an image of that which is outside. And the two are fundamentally the same. They are the one reality. And this is the basis of the looking glass universe. We go on, you'll see. Now, do you remember Richard Silverstein? How he used to put the transparencies on upside down. He was a professional lecturer. He did it intentionally. But I can assure you, if I put them up the wrong way, because I don't know how to do it any better. I've only just been starting to work with transparencies. That's fun, really fun. Anyway, you've got to put them on upside down. Now, this quotation is taken from this interesting book by the Auckland artist Kristen Zambucker, Anu in the Seed, which is the Kahuna philosophy of the Philippines, of Hawaii. Can you read it? We had to put the screen underneath here because there was too much light coming in on the opposite wall, but I'll read it out to you anyway. Anu, Anu, the seed. Though I may travel far, I will meet only what I carry with me. For every man is a mirror. We see only ourselves reflected in those around us. Their attitudes and actions are reflections of our own. The whole world and its conditions has its counterpart within us all. Turn the gaze inward, correct yourself, and your world will change. The solution to the paradox is within yourself. Of course, this, as you see, is what has been talked about in several of the sessions. Yeah. Now, well, this one's in good black-white. There are some scientists who are realizing this. And the quotations in this case come from Ken Wilber's Spectrum of Consciousness, where he put this very clearly. G. Spencer Brown, a physicist, I don't know much about him, but he put the whole thing in a nutshell. The world we know is constructed in order to know itself. That's the mirror image. But in order to do so, it must cut itself up into at least one state which sees and one which is seen, the primal duality. In this severed state, whatever it sees is only partially itself. In any attempt to see an object, it must act to make itself distinct from and therefore false to itself. And that's exactly what we do through the personality. We make ourselves false to our true spiritual nature. Clear? As clear as it can be. Now, it was also said again by another, quoted in the same book, another scientist. I've got a feeling this is Suzuki, but I didn't have time to look it up, the Zen Buddhist. The Atma, will, wants to know itself, and consciousness is awakened. And with the awakening of consciousness, the will is split in two. The one will, whole and complete in itself, is now at once actor and observed. Man has been thus enabled to see, but at the same time there is something which he, as observer, cannot see, and that's his own nature. He can only see his own nature by going into his inner consciousness and fusing with the one. Very beautifully put, both from scientists, or I might be wrong, you don't remember with Larry, you don't remember whether that was... It is Suzuki. So it isn't a scientist in that case, it's Zen Buddhist, but it doesn't matter very much. Now we'll see the way that H.P. Blavatsky put this. The non-dual nature of the one reality was clearly stated by H.P. Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine. And you remember, Jeffrey Farthing gave us this in his talk. The one absolute reality is all that was, is, or ever shall be, devoid of all attributes. It is beingness rather than being, and is beyond all thought or speculation. The important part there is to see devoid of all attributes. We sometimes forget that bit in what she said. It's devoid of all attributes because oneness, true reality, must be devoid of all attributes because it includes everything. And I can hear some of you saying, Jeffrey Farthing saying, now what's he going to put on there? Can you get it put on the right one? Where's Jeffrey? Put him there. Well, this is the one you want. This is from the book How to Study Theosophy. The teaching, again, H.P. Blavatsky, the teaching is that existence is one thing, not a collection of things linked together. Now, a motor car is a lot of parts put together, and it makes a unit. But that's not like the one reality. The one reality has no separate parts. It's all inclusive. It's not just a lot of little bits linked together. It is a field of oneness. Being absolute, there's nothing outside it. It is all being. It is indivisible. Else it would not be absolute. If a portion could be separated, that remaining could not be absolute, because there would at once arise the question of comparison between it and the separated part. Now the separated part, therefore, is an image. You see, this is the looking glass universe concept. That which is separated is an image or a reflection of the whole, but it is still the whole. Comparison is incompatible with any idea of absoluteness. Therefore, it is clear that this fundamental one existence or absolute being must be the reality in every form there is. She is clear about it. Non-dual, like the Advaita or the Vedanta, there is only the one. She has that non-dual way of looking at things. Now, I'm going to remember last night, Professor Elwood talked about the one and what he called the monotheistic and the polytheistic. In other words, we have aspects of the one. The various ways in which the one functions can be looked upon as separate. But it's an illusory separativeness. So we look upon the one as divine will, divine intelligence, and divine energy or love. Now, there are several ways of working out the Trinity, but this is the one I've chosen for this particular talk. If you don't like it, you still stick to your own idea of the Trinity. But I'm going to have a look at this question of the looking glass universe using these three divisions, if I had to call them, as a basis. Most of them will come under the divine will, because that is primary, that's Atma, and it at a higher level becomes Para-Atma. Para-Atma being the Atma at the level of the one life. When will functions, it has within it the will to grow to perfection. That's will. I should put that back. I'm doing it just a little too quickly. Will is the Atma, the will to live, to grow, to experience, and to return to wholeness. Wisdom is the divine intelligence, which provides the archetypal pattern for that growth and for that return to the one. And love, or divine energy, is that which builds the whole forms and through which life can express itself and which gives what some people now calling the glue that holds the whole of manifestation together. It is love as attraction that holds everything together. So will is power Atma, the absolute Atma, and it's in man also. Of course, we have Atma, according to the theosophical classification. And if you use the word divine will, it probably is more easily understood. So we'll use in these first few illustrations the illustration of light as being the Atma in man, the light that lighteth every man that cometh into the world. I'm taking to be divine will or Atma. Now, how does this primary light, let there be light, how does the primary light become the many? And you've probably seen this diagram before, but some of you haven't, so we'll have to. The one. This is the path of outgoing and return of all life. The outgoing from the source back to the source, which is the involutionary and evolutionary process. Now, the one light, which is and you can look upon the one light as focused through a prism. And when it's focused through the prism, it's split up into the spectrum, the seven colors of the spectrum. And each of those has its wavelength or vibratory rate, which gives it a particular shade of color. These shouldn't have been in separated colors. They, you know, in the rainbow, they fade one into the other. They fuse one into the other. So there's a gradation there of vibratory rate, which you get your divisions in that gradation fine enough, you can get an infinite number of vibratory rates. And that means that the monad, or the monadic force, or the Atma in everything that lives, because as we were told in the recent lecture, there is life in everything, and that life can have its own vibratory rate, each different from the other by a very small infinitesimal amount, yet sufficient to make it individual. So we get the many forms of this one life as the colors of the rainbow. But then if you put up another prism, the inverted, and probably you have to move them closer together, then you can get the white light again. So that is the path of outgoing and return, and gives us just no diagram. No, it is really completely helpful. It only stimulates a little bit. It only points towards the understanding of reality.
You have moved the last two into the last three into two, so it's all right.
Last two?
Three.
Oh, have I? Have I got them wrong?
You merged indigo into blue and violet.
Have I only got six colors? Oh, I see. Oh, yes, that's right. It is. I'm sort of combined about the difference between indigo and violet. That's what happened. Thank you for pointing it. I'll correct it. Now, this diagram I had before as a slide, which was rather beautiful because it was a photograph of a light within a cone. But then Dr. Tynley, in one of his books, suggests this idea that you have the central light, Power Atma, the one reality, there in the center. But as it is limited by what we call planes or worlds, it doesn't really matter, as it is limited, the light is obstructed or distorted, so that perception in the lower worlds, the physical world and the emotional and mental world, everything is a distortion of that one reality. Again, the idea to understand that you have to return to the source. And Mr. Jinrajadasa, in his book, little book, calls it Seven Veils Over Reality. Seven Veils Over Consciousness. And it's exactly the same idea. There's an awful lot of stuff about his cats and things in that book, but this idea in is tremendously important. Let me go from here. We've got a long way to go. I don't think of any questions. I can put this up anyway and it'll still be the same. This is a diagram that we had on that beautiful, the colored diagram, remember, that I showed you. It simply is the same thing. The center, Paramatma, the one life. As it extends out through... Where's John? Can you stick it on? I better hold on to it. The higher levels of consciousness, what we call the arupa, the formless levels of consciousness, atma, buddhi, manas in man, there the lines of consciousness intersect and we have a degree of unitive consciousness or oneness. Here it's complete. There's the absolute oneness. Here there's a degree of consciousness, what Ken Wilber calls the transpersonal belt, the transpersonal, what is it? Bands of consciousness. And here when we pass the middle of the mental world, we come into the lower mind, the emotional, and the physical. The point I want to make is that as we come out here, and the limitation is greatest, then we have these separate or self-centered foci of consciousness, which is the individual consciousness of every man. And you see everything as separate from yourself. But as Mrs. Besant said, when you turn inwards towards the center, you realize the oneness that lies behind the whole. And you can only do this by turning inwards. Now I'm going to go on. See if we can move a little more rapidly. Now this that I love this quotation. This is from Shirley MacLaine. And it's so simple. So perfect. Rudolf Steiner, Leadbeater. Well, that's spelled correctly. She spelled it wrong. Casey and so many countless others, all claiming the fundamental existence of a divine will, an energy force from which everything else sprang. The divine will was in all living things. We are part of it, and it was part of us. The task was to find that divinity in ourselves and to live by it. Now, in those underlined four words, you've got the whole philosophy, an ethical philosophy of life, which I think is quite extraordinary that she should be able to do it in so few words. It's self-explanatory. And these books of hers have been, there's an awful lot of other stuff in them, but all the way through, you've got these beautiful little snippets of... Now, she pointed out the need to live ethically in harmony with the divine energy, the oneness, the wholeness that is God. And this is in I think it's in the caves and jungles of Hindustan. This example was given in that book by H.P. Blavatsky, not very common. And I heard Hosking talking about it once, and I snapped it up. If you have one of those puzzles, you know, and you roll the mercury up to the top, It'll go up, but every now and again it slips off the path or whatever it is, and you get a lot of little droplets of mercury. But you can shake them together and they'll come together. But if you sprinkle sand or dust on those particles of mercury, they will not come together. The whole thing is that if consciousness is to become one with the one consciousness, then it must be pure. You see? It must be in harmony with the wholeness. It's very simple, but it's an interesting one. Now we're going to get on. What number am I up to? I don't know. I think I'll leave my notes behind and just go. This is the hologram, and some of you will admit this. This was it. What you actually do is you have a laser beam. I saw this in Sydney, and it was quite staggering. I don't know whether it's been shown in New Zealand yet, although they have the apparatus here. The laser beam is thrown on the mirror. Part of the beam goes back to here and onto the object, and some of the beam goes directly to the object. So you get what's called an interference pattern between those two beams on this photographic plate. And I have a slide of it, but I haven't got a diagram of it. It looks like a lot of little whirls and things. You really can't get any sense out of it at all. It's a chaotic pattern. But if you take that chaotic pattern up here and you reflect a laser beam onto it, you get out here a three-dimensional image of the object. And the best known one, which I saw in Sydney, was a girl's face. And if you looked at her from that point of view, she had a sour look on her face. And as you went round and round, the sour look changed into a smile, until from that side there was a perfectly wonderful smile. I believe there's some advertisements in New York that use this technique. But anyway, her face was right out of nowhere. It's quite amazing. But the point I really want to make, I've got another one of this. The point I really want to make about this is it's now being recognized or understood by some scientists that this is the same thing. Work it out for yourself if you like. Pardon? The first one was easier. No, this is a government publication by the what's the same as our DSIR in New Zealand. This is from the Looking Glass Universe, which I'll talk about in a moment. But anyway, the point is that if you take a little bit of this hologram or interference pattern and put laser light on the bit, then you can from that reproduce the whole. Now, it's not as good an image as if you use the whole interference pattern, but it's led some scientists, to realize that the whole of the universe is like a giant hologram. Each bit contains the whole, and the whole contains each bit. Now, there's your paradox, you see. As Shirley MacLaine put it, the whole is in the part, part is in the whole. She didn't put it like that. We are it and it is us. It's the same concept. So you've got, as it were, a huge computer in which everything exists. Some of you may look upon it as the Akashic record or the astral light at the lower level and so on. But you've got that whole computer in which everything exists. But what we see is only the bit that has been, the button has been pressed, and that particular bit has been fed out of the computer to become that which we can perceive. Pardon? All right. The audience is all important. This is the book.
Oh, yes.
Looking Glass Universe. Now, in modern sciences, in the last 50 years perhaps, in fact it goes back further, from the turn of the century, scientists came up against all sorts of things that shook the sciences, physics especially, to its foundations. Have you got that? Can we move on? And the first was this principle of uncertainty. And that means that they found that what they thought had always been a wave, that is, wave motion, was only wave motion. But then they found that it could be a particle as well. When it was affected by the conditions or by the observer, because again they realized that the observer had something to do with that which was observed. So this is the wave motion. Oh, I see it's going in that direction, but what's its position? Oh, that's its position, but where is it going to now? It's just the way this book put it. So this really started things going. The physicists found they couldn't use the old methods of investigation because they were no longer tenable. And this is when Newtonian physics didn't go out the door, but it was realized to be only part of the truth. Because we're moving on all the time, and each time we get a better image of the looking glass universe, a better understanding of it. Here's the wave particle detector in the waveform, and here the particle got stuck up in the corner. So that I won't go into it anymore. But wave, yes, yes, it because it isn't just one thing. It's a duality, and here's another duality for you to have a look at. Now, it was Thomas Kuhn's out of the same book. Oh, we're getting on pretty well, are we? Thomas Kuhn's wrote a book, K-U-H-N, in which he said the observer is the observed, and that scientists and all scientific thinking builds what he calls models, paradigms. And then that paradigm is held for a certain time. Then there's a quantum leap and change of understanding, and a new model or paradigm is made and worked upon. So it's a sort of, scientists think they've got the answer, but actually it is changing all the time. Their concepts are going on and on. So you see, one moment you see a rabbit, one moment you see a duck. But the image contains within it the ability to contain more than one thing. This is the way it was put in the Looking Glass Universe. I don't know if there's very much importance in that, but you can see the... Oh, I've got it wrong, have I? Well, that's not bad, first mistake. Terra cognita, the land we know. This is the perception of the world as we have built it up. And this is the perception of the world as it could be. You see there, you've got a sort of a hologram with the worlds and things. And that is the reality, because all possibilities are in there. In here, there is the possibility of seeing that which is within our powers of conception only, of perception only. This is the world as we perceive it with our limitations of consciousness. That is the whole. So the Looking Glass Universe, the reality, is whole. Now, there's another interesting little one. I think we're doing not too badly. This is rather good. You see, our perception is built up to see things within the limitations of our consciousness. So this poor rabbit when he looks at this, he sees a fish, like as I went to the aquarium yesterday, a fish facing him. But if, oh, there's two cameras here. That camera is taking the fish side on, and this one is taking the fish head on. And so the poor rabbit is watching these two television cameras, and like these two, and feels that that fish is different from that fish. You see what I'm getting at? Actually, it's the same fish, but seen from a different perspective, in a different way. So this could be multiplied now or expanded into a concept of the world in which that which we see is only a portion of the reality that is that object. I can't put this in words, but you can see this illustration is helpful in giving an idea of how that is. Oh, did I pull it out before? Yeah. Now, there's a man called David Bohm. I thought he was British, but actually he is was born in America. Oh, I'll put him down so that you can see his name. Not yet? David Bohm. He taught in, he's a physicist. He taught in the University of London, but he was born in America. He's done a lot of work with Krishnamurti, and we have some tapes where he has interviewed Krishnamurti, and the dialogue between the two is very interesting. Anyway, he took the idea of the hologram and expanded it into what he called the his book, Wholeness and the Implicate Order. Now, this actually sounds a terribly difficult thing to understand, but I don't think it's too bad. So I'll give you what I can understand of it. He worked with, David Bohm worked with Einstein also when he was younger. So he developed his ideas from the hologram. Everything exists in the whole, because that's the major idea behind the hologram. And behind the world as we know it is an implicate order from which the material world becomes explicit or recognizable, and the process is rather like unrolling a carpet. Now, in the carpet is the design, but you can't see it when it's rolled up, but as you roll it out, it becomes explicit. It becomes recognizable. You got the idea? Everything is within the whole. In the divine intelligence, if you like, it's more than that. Everything is in the whole, and when the button is pressed in that great computer, that little bit comes down into manifestation, into our consciousness, and can be recognized or perceived. Everything exists in the whole universe. Yes, and as a gigantic computer, if you like, and if you press the button to bring out of that computer a particular program or particular part of a program, then that comes into the world and becomes recognizable or explicit. You got the idea? Now, he did something that's really marvelous. Yeah. This is the marvelous one. I haven't seen it done, but I'll take his word for it. This is out of the universe, the book, The Universe Looking. Well, this is the book, but I did show you the front of it. It's available, I think, in the bookshop. If you have a cylinder with a special type of glycerine or something like that in it, and the cylinder is slowly revolving in a certain direction, you put it in a drop of dye, and the dye goes like this. Now, it wouldn't do it in water, it would dissolve, but it goes round and round like that as the cylinder revolves. Now, Bohm said he always used to surprise of people who were he was talking to by reversing the cylinder back the other way. And he says that the die goes back, the die goes back into the dot. And that's his example of the explicate and the implicate order. In the dot is the whole universe. When it becomes explicate, it goes as a pattern in the glycerine. But it can be reversed, can go back into the whole. Now this is Rupert Sheldrake, who we've been in contact with. We're trying to get him to come to New Zealand. He is a member of the society. He spoke at the
at
the convention in 1982 at Adyar,
immeasurably beyond
with Fitchoff Kapra. They were both there, the bright young men, because they are relatively young.
An ocean of energy. And an ocean of energy.
Now, I talked first of all about divine will, in which the whole exists. But I could have been, when I was talking about implicate and explicate order, I could have been talking about divine intelligence, what we call Mahat.
It's at the level of primary level.
But they overlap. Distinctions of primary duality, the primary trinity, are not very clear. None of these things really are clear, cut and dried distinctions. The archetypal world, from which everything in the world as we know it, is merely a projection. That in theosophical literature has been called the universal mind, the divine mind, Mahat, and a subject which has not been studied as much as it should have been. Well, now, Rupert Sheldrake is a British biologist, and he wrote his book called A New Science of Life. Unfortunately, it cost $50 or $60, but we have a copy in Jones Library, I think. He wrote this in India, where he was working. And he postulated this divine mind as morphogenetic fields beyond the physical, which guide all biological growth and all behavior. And the book is getting some recognition in scientific circles, but he's going on. He's a young man, and someday the importance of what he's written is going to be understood. Now, there was mention made of the 100th monkey phenomena. I gave a talk on this in Auckland and got bombarded and said it wasn't true. However, the principle of it, to me, is absolutely true. There were the monkeys in the north of Japan in one of the islands who were given sweet potatoes to eat. And these sweet potatoes were thrown out on the sand. And for a long time, they just ate them, sand and all. And then it was seen by scientific people watching, that young female monkeys discovered that by washing the potato in a stream, they could wash off the sand and it was much nicer to eat. Now, the young female monkeys taught that to some young male monkeys. And ultimately, their mothers picked up the idea. And gradually, the idea went on and on. But it was quite a while before the older male people joined in. Anyway, you want me to say it again? Anyway, there came a point where suddenly there was an explosion and all the monkeys were actually washing their potatoes. Not only on that island, but on adjacent islands. And this to me is obvious common sense. If you watch carefully, you can almost see. When I see a watch a cat crossing the road, I realized that when we first had cars that went at 25 mile an hour, the cat could get across the road quite easily. But now with cars traveling in the city at 40 and 50 miles an hour, the cat closes, has a look around, closes his eyes, and just go like that. They've had to adapt to the conditions in the world around us. And I believe that each animal is linked to an aspect of intelligence, the Mahat, universal intelligence, which is guides it instinctively. It's got its own individuality as well, but it links with an instinctive control, which is part of these morphogenetic fields about which Rupert Sheldrake is talking. Now, we can have another look at this and the way it's put in the Looking Glass Universe, which gives him a very good build-up. It does admit that he's being recognized rather... they're not very keen to recognize him. Now, do you see what this one is? The duck says, "For the first time in history, I was able to teach grade A rabbits to ride unicycles. It took them 3 months to learn." Right? Got that one? It's just a bit of fun. But they took 3 months to learn to ride the unicycle. Now he's telling that to the cat. This is out of that book, but they're very good. The cat says to the duck, "After you told me about your success, I tried it with A grades also, with grade A's also. But why did it take only 2 months?"
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the experience had been built into the morphogenetic fields, into the universal mind, and they learn through that universal mind. You're reading the little bit. You're spoiling it. Shall I read it down? I'd like to see that bloody duck learn to fly a kite. Yes.
We have a scientist that was quite critical of Rupert Sheldrake's work. That had a little cartoon that said, had two scientists looking at each other. And one said, "Have you noticed how Sheldrake's hypothesis is getting harder and harder to disprove with
that?" Getting what? I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear it.
Have you noticed how Sheldrake's hypothesis is getting harder and harder to disprove with that?
Oh, yes. Yes. Mother thought well. Well, now, where do we go? Oh, this is a real come down. A real come down. And we're getting back into the less interesting field of theosophy. And we're not a very good artist. But anyway, you see, we have always taught this, that everything is interconnected. If you throw a pebble into a pond, each particle of the water in that pond is displaced, is affected. And I always read here, something I was going to say. Yes, let me get back. I missed this out. Have you heard about the Gaia hypothesis? G-A-I-A, the Greek god, mother god of the earth. Dr. Lovelock produced a hypothesis which is very similar to Rupert Sheldrake's, in which he said that Mother Nature or the Earth ensures that the right conditions for growth, the right materials, the right temperatures and so on are there at every stage of the Earth's evolution. And if you go back to the time when oxygen was produced, you know, at the very early times, it was, and the water was produced. There wasn't any water, there was only fire. And then the water was produced, and oxygen and hydrogen, and then growth of living things like mosses and things started. All that, he shows that all through, there was exactly the right conditions provided by Mother Nature, implying that behind everything is this divine intelligence. It's an interesting book. It's been quoted by Dr. Lester Smith. I think it's An Intelligent Comes First. Anyway, just to go back to this, there's that from the Mistress of Heaven. What is it? It says Mistress. From, who's the man? I haven't got it here. Oh, my memory's gone. Francis Thompson. All things to each other, hiddenly linked are. There's a first line to it. What's it called? By immortal power, hiddenly to each other, linked are. Thou canst not stir a flower without troubling a star. And you see, that's the whole story. And that's entirely in line with the concept of the looking glass universe, the oneness that is hidden, but the oneness that is there all the time. Now, we are going to finish on time. In his book, The Spectrum of Consciousness, Ken Wilber says this: recall the essential insight of the work of Heisenberg, Schrodinger, and Einstein, that the texture of reality is one in which the observer and the event, the subject and the object, the knower and the known, are not separable. They are one. This type of knowing, which is non-dual, intimate and direct, does not submit to codification and analysis. And you all will know what from the unreal lead us to the real. And Dr. Timely says, lead us to the real. To see then that the unreal and the real are the same. The unreal and the real is a looking glass universe, but in fact they are both the same. And unless you understand the unreal and the real, you won't understand the whole. All right? Now, I think we're getting near the end. Ken Wilber again, he sums up the process. Thus, the real knower. Now, I want to say something about Ken Wilber. He has a habit, where's Larry? He puts the what we would call the transcendental, the unity of consciousness, below. And of course, the Christian religion and all theosophists put it away up here somewhere. So, you've got to remember that when you read him. Thus, the real knower is one with the universe of knowledge. Everything you observe is none other than you who are observing it. When you go right down into the very base of your consciousness, you find the universe. Not the false universe, not the Maya, or the false universe of objects out there, but the real universe, which is no longer imagined as split into a subject versus an object. At the very bottom of yourself, you fall out of yourself into reality. And of course, this is yoga. This is the experience of oneness. Only, of course, we don't like falling out. We rise up too. It sounds better. But it's exactly the same thing. Now, I'm going to stop where I started. You remember? How do I know myself? By knowing that the image, that which is outside me, is the same as myself. And it was put very beautifully. You remember? By Christian Zambucha. middle finger's there. Correct yourself and the world will change. And what Krishnamurti says, the world problem is the individual problem. So we've got to understand that it is a looking glass universe. We are the observed. Though I may travel far, I will meet only what I carry with me, for every man is a mirror. We see only ourselves reflected in those around us. Their attitudes and actions are reflections of our own. The whole world and its conditions has its counterpart within us all. Turn the gaze inward. Yoga. Self-knowledge. Self-realization. Turn the gaze inwards, correct yourself, and your world will change. Female with Bill. Bill Johnson was the one who's very keen on her, and he introduced us to this book. It's not easily obtained, but there's several of them, but they're very good. And the pictures are very good. I had them up at the and was at the Auckland Convention.
The thing is in that bookshop in the
Where?
I'm sorry, we had over time for questions this morning. But it's really a terribly exciting and interesting world that you showed us today.
Yeah.
A lot to think about. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.